not an address. It's our usual Sunday night shoe. The only thing is we're standing here this week. So to think at right angles. We've been learning Ilchus Tshuva in the Rambam. Any questions? On Sunday night you're supposed to ask questions. Alright, we were up to the stage. The last thing we saw together last week was the Rambam. Who's here for the first time on a Sunday night? What we've been studying together for the last few months has been the subject of tshuva, which is how to correct what you did wrong in the past. And the Rambam uses this as an opportunity to explain the concept of revising the past altogether. We've seen in the previous two chapters what happens when you have damaged some aspect of your own being or your own sensitivity, or you've damaged something in a relationship. He has explained to us how you go about correcting those areas. It's much more complicated if another person's involved. If it's only between you and Hashem, or you and damage in the spiritual world alone, it's much easier. Various levels and degrees, he's explained that to us. The thing we saw last time was the subject of this chapter is, first of all, that a person has a balance of positivity and negativity at any one moment. What you are intrinsically, is the balance of what you've chipped away or damaged in your own spiritual being and what you've built up. Right? You know, it's exactly like some kind of business enterprise. You're born with a certain amount of raw material, and what you've done with that raw material is what you are. The raw material itself doesn't count for anything. Because obviously, you can't take credit for what you were given as a given. If you were born good-looking or into a wealthy family or with lots of opportunities, those don't count for anything. In fact, in some ways, they're a big disadvantage, because if you're born with a lot of gifts, you tend to coast. That's a very interesting subject. People who are born and gifted tend very often to coast through life, doing well, riding on their gifts. And those people have got the biggest shock awaiting them in the spiritual dimension, because the only thing that counts there is the hard work that you did. Now, the only thing that counts is the percentage increase you made on your raw material. And therefore, if you've gifted enough to coast without any effort, so, you know, it says in Chazal that even if you're gifted in one area, then the biggest tests and ordeals and the most highest degree of accountability will be in that area. Since that was your specialty, so then you're going to be held much more accountable. And it always works that way. Which means a person, what we have to know from this, is that if you are gifted, you have to achieve much, much more than someone who's not gifted. And if you're gifted in a certain area, you have to achieve greatness in that area. It makes sense, right? You wouldn't ask a person who's skilled at plumbing, you wouldn't expect from him greatness in some other area, but you expect him to do plumbing well. And if he gets that wrong, he should be accountable in that area. That's the way it works. And that's the way it works in Torah and in life also. If you have a gift in a certain area, you know, there's a remarkable Gemara that says that last night we discussed the case of Rebbe Elazar Rebbe Shimon. He was the son of Rebbe Shimon Bar Yochai, who wrote the Zohar, and I mentioned last night that he was unburied for many years. It says that after he died for 18 years or 22 years, different opinions, he lay unburied in the attic of his house, and his wife used to visit him. There was a certain reason they couldn't bury him in that town, and it says that when she would, he was so perfectly preserved because of his spiritual greatness, his body had become, even his body had become sanctified to the level that it was able to maintain its purity even after death, even after the glow of spiritual energy had left it. It says that for 18 years he was so perfectly intact that when she used to, if a hair would fall out of his head, it would bleed. And the part I didn't mention last night is that it says that after 18 years, once she went up to see him and there was a worm on his ear. So she was very distressed, because it meant obviously there was some imperfection. If he was subject to decay in any way, it means that there must have been something less than perfect about him. So he came to her in a dream. The Gemara says he came to her in a dream, and he told her not to be upset. The reason that the worm appeared on his ear was because once he had heard a Torah sage insulted. Once he'd heard a Talmud Chacham insulted, and he hadn't defended him as he should have. The ear that had heard a sage, a representative of Torah, offended and insulted and hadn't come to his defense as actively as he should have, so the punishment of that ear was subject, not the rest of the body, only the organ that was involved. So the Baal Eim Musa explained that that was his particular strong point. That's how you have to understand that, Gemara. His particular strength, and he was a very great man, as I tried to explain last night. He was in a realm that we can't begin to appreciate from the vantage point of this generation. But his particular greatness was that he never let an insult to a Torah sage go past without intense reaction and defense. So once, when he reacted slightly less than he should have, that had a permanent damaging effect. It's a remarkable thing. The frightening side for us, of course, is that where our particular, your particular specialty lies, you can't afford to make a mistake over there. Right? Because that's where you're held accountable. Now, that's what we saw. That's the basis of much of that's being discussed here. So the Rambam said as follows, that when they make the accounting, they weigh up the positivity that you've generated, the work you've done on yourself, and it's weighed up in proportion to the gifts that you were given and the hard work that you had to do. We're very careful about this. It doesn't mean that you should choose areas of greatest difficulty. It doesn't mean that. You have to make a very wise decision about where your gifts are and work with your gifts, and also the most difficult areas that you have, because you're failing in those areas, and work very hard on them. It's a very difficult calculation. We once discussed on a Sunday night before, a couple of months ago, how a person draws the circle of what his particular character and personality constellation is, so that a person can know what it is they're supposed to be doing in the world as an individual, because everybody's got a unique job to do. We're not going to go through that subject again now. Maybe if people want to, we can do it again in the future. But that's the subject. So it's a very complex thing, because when a person works out what it is that they're supposed to be, you have to take into account two remarkably opposite factors. One is where my gifts are, where I don't have to work. In other words, I don't have to work to function there, so that I can work hard in those areas in order to achieve greatness in those areas. But I dare not leave areas out where I'm failing, because to be complete, I have to bring along the areas where I'm failing. But of course, what a person must never do is take on areas that are irrelevant, right, to a person's own. If a person's failing in essential areas like sensitivity to other people, empathizing with other people, things that you have to have as a normal human being, even though you don't do well in those areas, you very much have to work on those areas. But you'd be foolish to take on areas that aren't demanded of you, right, that you don't have to have, and put energy into those areas. That energy must go for areas where you're a specialist. Now, sometimes you have a difficult job. I had a friend at school who went for an aptitude test. He was very gifted intellectually. One of the most brilliant minds I think this country ever produced. And he went for an aptitude, but socially, he didn't quite have the skills of many others. He was very bright intellectually, but he went for this very high-powered aptitude test, and the printout said that he should become a lighthouse keeper. So that kind of personality, there's a lot of work to do in certain areas. But also, he is expected to achieve greatness in his area of gift also. And that's some of the factors that the Rambam means to be taken into account when he says that you're weighed up in terms of your merits and demerits. Right? Everything's balanced according to the measure of your particular personality. It's not just that you did this mitzvah and you did that avera. For you, that mitzvah might have cost a great deal and therefore be worth much more than for somebody else. You got a small effort, huh? And so it goes. That's the balance that he mentioned to us before. Then we saw the next section, subsection, was that just like this accounting stands at any moment and it goes according to what you've recreated of the past. In other words, not only have you achieved certain things and maybe damaged certain other things, but also you may have recreated or repaired damage that you did through these mitzvahs of tshuva. That also complicates the picture. You might have a lot of debits to your account, and you might have worked very hard in the mitzvahs that he mentioned before, the mitzvahs of tshuva, to recoup a lot of the damage and repair a lot of the damage you did. So at that point the Rambam said, and that was the last thing we saw together, that anybody who regrets a mitzvah that they did, they wipe out the mitzvah. Just like you can regret an avera, something that you did wrongly, and if you regret it properly, with all the technical requirements that we saw before, then you negate that negative action. Now, even if it was very negative, as we said before, even if you created a reality in the world, like even it says, if a man has a forbidden relationship with a woman and a child is born with a spiritual stigma because the relationship, let's say a married woman, not married to him, so that child's born with a very negative spiritual energy in the world. even that a person can correct. How he can correct the consequence in the world is a great mystery. That he can't do, it says. But Hashem takes care of that. The person can, however, change when they come to him, right? When they come to him and say that you caused this damage in the world and you're being held to account, if the person's done tshuva actively enough, that he's no longer the same person who did it. And they can't pin it on him. But you have to change your address literally. You have to literally change who you are for that. But even that can be done. Now, if that can be done, we said that, and I think this is the last thing we said, that if there's a rule in the spiritual world, it always works equally on both sides. Which means, if you can regret an avera and wipe it out, then it follows that you can regret a mitzvah and wipe it out. That's the negative side of that coin, of that balance. That if you want to have in the world the ability to go back on your past and negate, dissolve certain damage that you did, but you have the same tool that if you go back and negate or regret deeply enough certain things that you did positively, unfortunately those disappear also. A person has to know that. Therefore a person should take care never to regret a mitzvah, even if it costs dearly later. Even if a person would do a mitzvah and then be given a test where, let's say you gave money to its doctor, and you gave it, let's say, you gave the money, and then it turned out right after that you needed it. Should never regret what you did, because you'd wipe out the value, and as we explained last week in great detail, that would leave you on a lower level than you were before you did the mitzvah. Right? Because you sank now to a point where you wouldn't do it again. That's why a person should take great care never to do that. Let's continue. Are there any questions up to this point? Why don't you ask questions on a Sunday night? It's either totally clear, or you're not with it at all.
What if someone realized they've done wrong, said they haven't performed certain mitzvahs? Take example, a person opted by mitzvahs but they like to be in the mouth, Jewish person. And then he decides one day he's going to like to be, but he doesn't regret not liking him in the past. Is he forgiven for the bad of not liking him in the past?
It's a very interesting question, and you've chosen a very unusual example. The Rambam on the next page is going to speak about tefillin because it has a unique characteristic. A very, very frightening, unique characteristic. The Rambam is going to tell us that somebody who never put on tefillin ever is in a desperate situation. There are other opinions that it means every day, but the Rambam says that for a share in the next world, you'll see, putting on tefillin, I strongly recommend, that if you're sitting on this half of the room. Not so funny. Rashi's granddaughters used to put on tefillin, says. Talis and tefillin, I think. And Michal, the daughter of Shaul, she used to wear tefillin also. As all the ladies who come on a Tuesday morning will know, Rabbi Auerbach's been going through the fascinating life of Michal. But before you rush out to put on tefillin, what you should rather do is buy a pair for whoever's sitting on this side of the room. And you should definitely put on tefillin once, even if you borrow them. But at least once for sure you should put on kosher tefillin. At least once. You'll see the reason on the next page. Before, if we don't get there by tonight, rush out today, not tomorrow, and while you're still around in the world, put on tefillin, okay? At least once. Don't ask questions, just do it. We'll see the reason a little bit more in detail later. So you've chosen an unusual example. But what you meant to ask, I think, was the general concept of positive mitzvahs. Not where you damaged something, but where you didn't fulfill a positive commandment. Not like you didn't say Shema, or you didn't put on tefillin. So there it says like this, that if you regret that, you can wipe out the damage. You can wipe out the damage, but the benefit you can never regain. That means, you follow, you can never create a reality. Let's say you're supposed to say Shema every day, morning and evening. So a person who wakes up later in life to the fact that they have this obligation, they didn't know about it before, even under the best circumstances, so they'll have a perfect watertight excuse. And they won't be punished in any way. But the positivity of having done that mitzvah in the world, that there won't be. That will have to be regained later in the spiritual balance that will happen when the world finally reaches its final cosmic perfection, structure, whatever, then that benefit will have to come about. And it may well have to come about through suffering in one way or another, because it was needed to perform certain tikkunim, which means certain mystical corrections in the world. All very mystical stuff. But it has to be done. But Hashem will take care of it in one way or another, which we don't understand, and that value of that mitzvah will be done somehow. But you cannot recap that. And by the way, that's a fascinating idea that I haven't mentioned before, that you must remember that when you do tshuva for a thing, you must be very careful. What you end up with when you do tshuva is a perfect excuse, but the mitzvah you don't have. If a person couldn't come and learn, let's say a person had a day where they could come sit in the Beis Midrash and learn Torah, and they couldn't come that day, they were sick. Let's say they really couldn't come. They're genuine, they weren't faking it or rationalizing, they really couldn't come. So it says in the next world they will not hold it against you. Because you had an excuse, but the learning you won't have. A Talmid Chacham you won't be. You'll have a perfect excuse, but you'll be an empty excuse. the content you won't have. Are you with me? A fascinating application of this example, a wonderful type of question, I've got something to talk about, is a fascinating application of this is that there's the following problem which people often ask, like this. The Rambam says clearly, and you should have picked it up through everything that he's been saying up to now, that if a person does tshuva correctly, they absolutely completely wipe out all aspects of the negativity of what they did. Now, where there are some exceptions, and even those have to be understood, they're really not exceptions, they just appear to be. We'll see those in Mitzvah Shem soon. But the Rambam says, and we have a clear principle, that if a person will do a sincere tshuva, he can wipe out all negativity that he did or she did. If he does it in the last moment of his life, theoretically, let's say a person's dying, and in the last moment of his life, he does a sincere, complete, total tshuva. It's not easy, I wouldn't leave it till then. Right? Because in 1 minute, to sincerely reform your consciousness, tshuva doesn't just mean that you quickly say you're sorry. It doesn't mean that. Tshuva means that you sincerely work through and revise your consciousness so that you are such a new person that you wouldn't do any of those things again if you had the opportunity. That's not just, but if there's one mitzvah that has to be done with intent, it's tshuva. Many other mitzvahs can be just done as a mechanical action. You shouldn't do it that way, but the mitzvah is valid. But there are one or two mitzvahs that you can't do as a mechanical action. You can't say you're sorry as a mechanical action. The whole idea of tshuva is to reform who you are. But if theoretically, let's just say there was someone, just say, that in the last minute of his life, there was, and the Gemara says there were people, Shekoina Elamo B'Sha'a Achas, there were people who were able to gain their world to come in 1 moment. The Gemara says there was even a Roman. There was a Roman, a coarse, crude Roman soldier who was detailed to torture a Jew. He was burning to death one of the sages or one of the Jews of that period. And his job was to put water on the man's heart to keep him burning slower. He had a sponge, and he had to, as the man was being burnt at the stake, right, or on the crucifix, whatever it was, this Roman's job was to wet the area around his heart so he would burn, die slower. Now, that was the way they functioned. And I think the Jew asked him not to do it, or I don't remember exactly what happened, but he suddenly realized what he was doing, fanned the flames so that he should speed the man's death. And that's halakhically problematic also. But in other words, he decided to reduce his suffering instead of, right, suddenly in that moment, and he leapt into the fire himself. The Gemara says that man acquired his share in the next world. But that means his whole life was a life of such coarse crudeness. But he had that spark of sensitivity that enabled him to. The Gemara says even that there was also a Roman who was a Roman soldier, I think also in a similar sense. I don't remember the details, but I remember that as a final act, when he had to do something intensely barbaric, instead of doing it, he finally realized what it was that he was doing as a human being, and decided in that moment that he was put to death at that moment. Either he was put to death by the others, by the other Romans. I don't remember, but it was the moment of his death. He knew that making the right choice would cost him his life. But in doing so, in falling to the ground, he fell on such a way, a remarkable thing. He realized what the Jews were. At that moment, you have to understand this, at that moment of intense self-realization that he was torturing a human being to death and what it meant, and this was a Jew, and what the Jewish people represented, what he represented, he decided at that moment to become Jewish. And he fell in such a way that he was circumcised on a stone, deliberately. He did that to himself, that he should die. That should be his final and a remarkable thing. That man, it says, acquired his world to come in a moment. So it is possible. And as Gemara says, also there was a sage, unfortunately, this is not the one I can tell you in mixed company, but you can go and look it up, or you can speak to me privately if you belong to this side of the room, that one of the great Tanoim had an urge to go and visit a certain woman who lived in a certain place. She wasn't teaching Mishnah, that woman. But she was, the Gemara says she was world famous. She was a world famous woman. She was the most famous woman of that. persuasion. And then the most exciting part of the story I can't tell you, but a certain thing happened. And at that critical moment, when that's a remarkable thing that happened, but at that moment he suddenly realized what he'd done and what he'd become. And it says he went out and he sat down and he put his head between his knees and his soul, his neshama, left him. That he did such an intense act of tshuva that he actually gave back his neshama. That means the Gemara says it's a fascinating idea. Let me ask you a question. What bothers you about that story? Not the ones that, if I've asked you this before, don't answer. What's difficult? What's the most difficult, problematic part of that story? If you've got any head for Gemara, you'll pick up something very difficult. No office? The ladies? What's the most problematic? What bothers you about that story? What? He died instantaneously. Doesn't bother me. Of course. Oh, you see, the ladies always get it. Huh? Without Gan Yeshiva, proves it. Without Gan Yeshiva. Why did he put his head between his knees? What's that got to do with the story? Doesn't that bother you? Why not? There's nothing in Torah that's irrelevant. If it says, so now see if you can answer it. Shame. That's a good idea. But the mystical writings say that it's the fetal position. That means he so cleansed himself at that instant. That means, because it says in the Gemara that inside the mother, the child has its head between its knees, its elbows down, and it describes, which means that at that moment he was able to go back to that point. It's a beautiful thing. That's what the Gemara is telling you. Simple, right? Now, so there are people. Now, so let this understand. Which means this, that it's possible that in a moment, a person could acquire an intense, right, new reality. But to do that, you have to completely wipe out the past. Now, the problem that we have to understand is this. Let's say a person could do that. As I said before, it's extremely difficult. These are acts of heroism. Very difficult to do. But let's say a person could do that. The problem is this. Here's a person who lived all his life in the most intense negativity. This person practiced evil actively all his life. And at the end of 120 years of evil, he does this act of tshuva and he has an absolutely, completely clean slate. Here's another individual who's labored all his life for 120 years to be a great tzaddik. He's avoided every temptation in life. He's been self-discipline has been intense. He's worked on himself tremendously, right? He's going to end up the same as this other individual. It's not fair. He's got a fantastic share in the next world because of the purity that he maintained in himself. Here's this other individual. He had the best of both worlds. He lived in the most negative way in this world. In the last instant of his life, he managed to wipe it all out, and it's guaranteed that he has a completely clean slate. That's a very difficult question, right? No? The answer, however, if you think about it, not that difficult, and the answer is as follows. Very clear. I heard this from a very great man. When a person wipes the slate clean, and this is the thing that you asked. It's a very intense example of what you asked. When a person wipes the slate clean, he cleanses himself entirely, and there's no account to be settled and no punishment to be meted out. But content he doesn't have. Content he doesn't have. You have to understand that. That means this person is the one who's been working on himself for 120 years, the way he's been, let's say, I'll give you a simple analogy would be, imagine a person who's been picking up weights in a gym all his life. So he would end up very, 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 right, a gesunte body that he'd end up, right? So that's what this individual, in other words, to build spiritual reality, you have to pick up weights also. You also have to work against resistance, and you need Torah and mitzvahs to feed the neshama. This other individual hasn't been working against resistance, and he hasn't been feeding the neshama with Torah and mitzvahs. It's a very scrawny individual. He's a threadbare neshama. You follow? The difference is this, that he has a clean slate. He's going to make it into the right dimension. He has no price to be paid, no account to be settled, but muscle he doesn't have. There's an enormous difference, you follow, between those two people. The one who worked on himself all his life, he also doesn't have any account to be settled, but he's a kezunta neshama in that world. Whereas the one who didn't work on himself, obviously, he makes it in by the skin of his teeth, and he has a very much back row seat over there, whatever that means. Right? There are people there, it says, who eat at other people's tables. They don't have their own. That means they don't have a share in the next world. They do get there. All Jews will get there. Non-Jews also, but it's a separate discussion. All Jews will get there, but they have some people have a share, and others don't have a share. That means that they're there, but they have to eat at other people's. They have to be waited to be invited in. Okay. Any other questions on what we've discussed? Yes, please. Is that terrible? The question was, what happens if somebody does a mitzvah that they don't really want to do, and they do it resentfully, and they do it negatively and resentfully? The truth is that it says that that's one of the best kind of mitzvahs you could do. Because when there's no desire to do it, and you're forcing yourself to do it only because you know it's right, not for ulterior motives, that's another problem. If you do it for honor, or to keep up with a social thing, or for other ulterior motives, it's also a valid mitzvah. And you should do it anyway, rather than not do it. But that's got lower value. But when you do an action, because morally you know it's correct, even though it's painful and you don't want to do it and it upsets you and so forth and so on, so then you get greater reward for that than a mitzvah that you enjoyed. The reason is because everything goes according to the level of difficulty. And the more you had to break down in your own personality, the more you had to conquer in your own negativity, your own resistance, the more work you did on yourself, that's a much more precious mitzvah than one that you were spontaneously motivated to do. If you were entirely spontaneously motivated to do it, right, then you don't gain anywhere near as much as when you had to work against resistance. When a mother shows love for a child, she doesn't get the reward that a I'm not saying, of course she should do it and there's reward, but not the same as a person who has to go against all their instincts to do so, obviously. The trick, however, is if you're ever in such a situation, this is just a basic idea in Torah Hashkafa, and that is this. The mistake that we usually make in that situation is we go into it with resentment. You can put the final cherry on top of that mitzvah and make it absolutely ultimate perfection by saying to yourself that now that I have to do it anyway, appreciating its beauty and actually doing it with simcha. If you do that, that's the absolute ultimate level that you could possibly do. Something you didn't want to do, you force yourself to do it because you know it's right, you reach the level of doing it, and you actually put simcha into it as well, that's a fantastic level. The paradox of human behavior in this area is that we'll do what's right, but with such regret and resentment that we'll often not only achieve a much lower level, often spoil the mitzvah. There's a remarkable thing, we learn this, it says that, if I'm not mistaken, David HaMelech had a general called Yoav. Yoav was a great warrior. But the Talmud describes him in words that mean a worm and wood. Hard and soft. Soft like a worm, hard like wood. And the Mefarshim explained that it means because there were times when he was on the battlefield, he was like a rock. But when he was in the Beis Medrash learning Torah, he was soft as a worm. What it means is that he utilized the full extent of his personality in the right way at the right time. What we do is exactly the opposite. We'll do one thing, but we'll be so resentful that we're doing that and we should rather be doing the other, that will make everyone's life a misery and will, you know, like a mother who knows a child should be allowed out that night. So she brings herself to the point where she allows the child out, but she says to him, you're going to have a good time, I'll just sit home with a can of beans. No, that kind of thing. In other words, that not to be done. In Torah, you often have that. There's a classical situation where a young man is learning in yeshiva, often happens in Kodal, sitting and learning, and his wife is at home struggling and she might need him that day. And he has a tremendous ordeal whether he should let down the team in the yeshiva and let down the Torah learning and his chavrusa, and he should go home and help his wife as an act of kindness, or whether she can actually cope and he should actually allow her to cope and she actually wants to do that and he should stay and learn Torah, which is his obligation. Well, the paradox is that it's very, very rare for someone to get it right. What happens is he goes home and helps her, but he's so resentful and he's so convinced that he shouldn't be there, he should be back there, that he makes a life of absolute misery much worse than if he hadn't come home to help. And if he doesn't go home, he sits in the shiva worrying about what an animal he is, that he's not home helping his wife, that he hasn't learned anything. So the trick is to make a decision, and it's easy to talk, it's very hard to do, but the trick is to make a decision that this is right, and then to do it totally wholeheartedly. It's a remarkable talent if somebody can develop that, and something that has to be worked on for a lifetime. If you get, the question was, what happens if you do a mitzvah that involves another human being, not Hashem, and you get a negative feedback from them, right? They show you only bitterness and a negative reaction, and they're very nasty about it. And then you end up feeling regretful or resentful. Again, the same thing applies. The more difficult they make it for you, the more you should treasure that mitzvah. Because if they respond positively to you, you're not doing it for the mitzvah, you're doing it because you feel warm about it, you feel good about it, you get a reward. If you do a mitzvah that you know you should do out of intense obligation, and they throw it back at you, so that shouldn't lessen your desire to do that. Ultimately, you're not doing it for them. You're doing it because it's a mitzvah that Hashem wants you to do. Right? And therefore, you should treasure it more. Only, and here comes the bad news. I understand your question. And here comes the difficult news. What I said now was easy, and you knew the answer. But here comes the difficult part. And that is that when the mitzvah involves another human being, I think we discussed this once a long time ago, there's a very, very difficult thing that has to be understood, and that is that a mitzvah involving a human being, the mitzvah is for the person. What Hashem wants, when you do the mitzvah, is that you genuinely, sincerely focus on the person, not on Hashem. The problem is as follows. Every mitzvah that you do between, you know, there are two groups of mitzvahs, right? Between a person and God and between a person and another person. The problem is, mitzvahs that are between you and another human being are actually between you and Hashem too, because He told you to do them. So the commentaries all ask, what's the difference? Why break them down into two categories when you're really doing what Hashem... What's the difference if you shake a lulav, which Hashem wants, or you go and visit someone who's sick? Both of them are a relationship to Hashem. The other person says, your opportunity to do the mitzvah, just like it happens to be Sukkot today and you got a lulav, so that person says, can you go visit him? Right? But the difference is enormous, and almost everybody gets it wrong. People who frum get it wrong. People who are not frum don't get this wrong at all, because they don't know the difference. They go out of motivation to help a human being. But people who become involved in Torah often make this mistake. They go and visit the person, they don't even see the person. They're only doing this because they're so frum that Hashem wants it, and they forget the human being. The mitzvah is to see the human being. The mitzvah is to visit the person who's sick. That's a difficult trick. It means at the back of your mind you have to know that you're doing this because Hashem ultimately wants you to do this. But you have to raise yourself to the level where it's so natural that you do it anyway, even if he wouldn't command you, and what you're thinking about at the time is the person. One great Rosh Yeshiva said that, I don't want to be your Ezra. I don't want to be your Lulav. When a person can be sick, and other people can come and visit them, and you can feel that they're shaking you like a Lulav. You are, you follow me, you're just their opportunity for a mitzvah, and I'm seeing you. And of course, the sicker you are, the more hidu, in the more muhuda your esrog is, the more beautiful it is. And if you're really sick, if you're really critical, boy, they're really happy about it. Because now, you follow, you hear that our krumit can come out.
Rabbi?
Obviously, that's not the way to relate to mitzvah. So, it comes out a very difficult exercise. When you do a mitzvah that's between you and another human being, you have to actually see the human being as being so special and needing your, you know, mitzvah. And so, that you, which means that when the person throws it back at you, here comes the hard part. When they throw back a mitzvah at you and they don't appreciate it, it's not good enough. I mean, the minimum level is to say, well, I have to do it anyway, and just grit your teeth and go ahead and do it. And if that's all you can muster, then that's what you must do. But not to forget that what you're actually doing is a mitzvah set. Let me give you an example that will make it clear. Let's say it's a question of relating to a parent. And the parent, let's say, you need to show kindness to that parent, let's say. And the parent, let's say, is an embittered person, and they might not appreciate you. They might make it very difficult for you for whatever reason, let's say. Now, the problem would be, it can happen with a child. Sometimes a parent doing for a child, it can be, it works both ways. The thing is that if you go into the mitzvah saying that now they are giving it back to me negatively, so I'm going to grit my teeth and just go ahead and do it, you won't do it. You won't do the mitzvah. Because if you're not concentrating on the person's needs, you won't be doing what they need, and therefore you won't be doing the mitzvah at all. Which means that the trick of that mitzvah is to remain sensitive to the person, even though they're not allowing you to be sensitive to them. That's a remarkable trick. That means you have to keep, simply put, it means this, that when the mitzvah involves another human being, the focus must always be the need of that person. It can never be that I'm just doing this because Hashem wants and then not see them. You just can't do that. It's a very hard thing to do. But you have to do that also.
Actually, you answered the question that I was going to ask, because I wanted to ask you about an actual mitzvah without a person having to say, well, today I've got to chalk up 10 mitzvahs for my credit. Like, I know that visiting the sick is one of the mitzvahs, and you'll find somebody on a Friday afternoon saying that I better go and visit 10 people to chalk up the mitzvahs.
Right.
That's what bothers me, is the natural mitzvah of doing what your heart really tells
right.
you to
we
do.
Did, I think we did discuss this last week or a couple of weeks ago, but very briefly, the question that's been asked is a fascinating and most important question. I'm not going to go through all the details again, is that, can I put it another way if you don't mind?
Absolutely.
That is, when you get involved in mitzvahs, you lose spontaneity. Because you feel you're obliged to do the mitzvah now, and so the natural human warmth that you might have felt in that situation, often you don't feel, and it can become a very, very mercenary kind of a thing. You have to chalk up this many that, or you have to... But the idea behind it, we did discuss it in detail before, is that the object of the mitzvah is to train you to feel it so much that you would do it anyway. And if you see people of greatness, and I think I mentioned this before, if you have the opportunity to be with people who've achieved some level in Torah, you'll see glowing in them the kindness and the love for people that definitely can't be faked at all. Right? You know, what can I tell you? I'll tell you a small example that happened to me. I don't think it's worth much in the telling because you have to see it, but it impressed me very, very much, even though it was a very simple thing. I once was sitting in a car with a very great man, Rav Simcha Wasserman. Today, Leonora, 90, 91 years old. It was about 3, 4, 5 years ago. He was in his mid-80s, very old man. One of the great Rosh Yeshivas of this generation. His father was the Rav Yochanan Wasserman, who was wiped out. His whole family was destroyed by the Germans. He never merited to have children. He and his wife live in Yerushalayim today. They never merited to have children. I was sitting with him. He was too difficult for him to walk. We went to the funeral of Rav Moshe Feinstein. He must have been there 250,000 people, 300,000 people. He couldn't walk the distance from Geula where the burial was. So we managed to get a car in. My brother-in-law, who's a doctor, was his physician. was taking him, and we managed to get the car into those streets which had all been blocked off. And we were sitting in the car amid a throng of people, which was an unbelievable experience. There were 300,000 people, a mass of people that turned out, many, many non-Frum people had come. It was a very, very, very powerful experience. But the crowd was so thick and so intense that nobody could move. The only way people moved was as the crowd surged in those narrow streets. Everyone moved with the crowd. And he was sitting at the passenger seat, and the window next to him was open. And a child of about 10 was standing next to the car, completely surrounded by all the people. And there was a surge in the crowd, and the child was crushed against the car. The child started to be crushed against the car. And he put out his hands, an old man of 85, and he pushed the whole crowd off with his hand. He shouted, "Akint, Akint," and he held everything off with his, but the intensity, it's not much of a story to tell you. But had you seen that, you would have seen the genuine, there was no tokenism there about a man kind of, and he never had children to relate to. It's not like he understands what it is from, it's a remarkable thing. But you see, if you're with people, you see glowing out of him in every crevice, every action, you'll see that they don't do mitzvahs technically. They've used the mitzvahs to. This, if you really want to know, is a problem of our generation. It's a problem because this is a generation that observes Torah observance in a very superficial way. Many of us have come to it in a conscious way later in life. We weren't brought up that way. And even those who were brought up with more or less of it, it wasn't like being brought up in the old generation. Our parents' generation were brought up in a normal Jewish environment, even if they weren't observant, but they were intensely imbued with normal Jewish values. You follow me? We've discussed this before also. If you look at people of our parents and certainly grandparents' generation, you'll find that even those who had no vestige almost of Torah observance, but in terms of human decency and warmth and a heart being in the right place, we don't begin to compare to what they were. With all our Frum observance and super, that's a remarkable feature of the descent of our generation, that we have to work very hard just to be outwardly normal to some extent, whereas they were so imbued with the old values and what it meant that they were able to do that. So for us, it's an enormous challenge. They had the heart, even though they might not have had the technical observance. We have the technical side. We have to work very hard to get the heart into it. That's a well-known experience by the Tshuva go through, that they always emphasize. We once said that we would have an evening devoted to the problems of becoming Frum and what it means personally and relating to families. But it's an enormous area of difficulty. You'll see that most of the Baalei Teshuva are people who become involved. And the lucky ones manage to get through this phase after a long time of balancing out. But the phase of active involvement is where a person becomes very, very concerned about the superficial details, but the internal content they forget entirely. For example, getting involved in the very detailed application of what's kosher and what's not, and driving parents crazy, right, which is a much bigger mitzvah than the kind of details they're attending to. Or getting involved in eating the right amount, getting the shear right. If you go to any Baal Teshuva home today, you'll see the Kiddush cup is enormous. Right? Because there's 5 different halakhic opinions about how much it should, and he's terrified of not getting it right, so he has the biggest one. If you see the Chazon Ish's Kiddush cup or the Chofetz Chaim's, it's quite a small Kiddush cup. It's unbelievable. People who actually see it can't believe that they were so lenient. They've forgotten that they weren't lenient, they're just extreme. Or, I'm not ashamed to tell you, at our Pesach Seder, my mother says, she can tell you, that often my mother would say at the Seder, we didn't used to do this at home. She came from a very observant home. We didn't used to do this at home because we'd be going crazy with measuring out the size of the matzah and weighing it and having everything prepared. And once it happened that, once the same man I mentioned to you before, the great Rosh Yeshiva brought up, in the deepest of Torah traditions, once he was out, we merited to have him at our Pesach Seder. And we had prepared everything like only a Baal Teshuva could. My brother-in-law had cut out cardboards the size of the shear of matzah to be sure that he wouldn't eat a grain. And of course, you realize the absurdity of it. Because, there are many chumras when you eat the matzah. First of all, there are different opinions about the size. So, of course, we had the biggest. Then there are some opinions that you should eat double that shear at certain occasions, on 2 different occasions. So we had double, single, and then double, right, for the people. And then, right, and then we had it of hand-baked matzahs, okay, which is, and then on top of all that, there's another chumra that not only do you have to eat the right amount, but you have to eat it in a certain amount of time. According to one opinion, you have 9 minutes to eat it. But according to the strictest opinion, you have to eat it all in 2 minutes. So now, 1 second. If you have a modest, moderate-sized piece of matzah and you've got 9 minutes, there's no problem. But if you're going to be extreme on the amount and you're going to extreme on the time, well, it just, there's no pleasure in the mitzvah, So that's what it is. So when we came, that's how the Seder went. And when we came to the Maror, we had this romaine lettuce and we had it, calculated with calculus. We had at least 5 times as much as anybody. Everybody got about 0.5 ton of lettuce. So when it came time to take the marrow, we saw Rav Wasserman reached over and he took a bunch. took a bunch. It's a mitzvah d'oraisa, you know, it's a serious. So we were horrified. We said, if simple as that, like enough. So he looked at me and said, yes, it's about a kazayas, isn't it? You know, it's about the size of an olive, isn't it? Isn't that what we want about? You know, we've been measuring for weeks, you know. That's what happens. You know, the outward thing, but the inner content, you know, we have to work on it. Yeah.
What about if you are the recipient of someone who's sick and someone comes to visit you and they visit you in such a way that you know that they actually don't want to be there, they don't want to visit you, they don't actually feel anything about you, but you know that they're doing it because Hashem commanded them to. Do you accept their visiting in the same way as when you're accepting someone who really wants to visit you? Or can you turn your back and say, well,
the question was, did you all hear the question at the back? No, the way you should handle such a mitzvah is you should give them the credit for having done the mitzvah, even though they haven't yet raised themselves to the level where they really empathize and understand, right? In addition to that, you should use it as an opportunity for your own growth, because you should be sorry for such a person. Because if you have any insight into it, you'll know that it says that one of the reasons you should visit a person who's sick is to understand what it means, because there's a lesson to be learned from that illness. And if the person learns the lesson, he may never have to get sick himself. But if he doesn't learn the lesson, he may have to be visited with the same illness himself or some equivalent in order to teach the lesson that Hashem gave him an opportunity here to learn. You should be intensely sorry for that individual that is not able to make the connection and to actually feel what he should be feeling. If you're really capable of it, you should help that person to try and feel a little bit about what he should be doing. And if you're really idealistic about it, you can actually help him do the mitzvah. Because when you visit the sick, you actually have to, there are technical requirements. You first of all have to express a wish for their, you should actually pray for their well-being, not just sit there. You have to. Some people say if you say Refuah Shlema, like you wish them, that's already in the category of a prayer that they should get better. You also have to do something for them. You have to do something practical. The Gemara says when they visited certain Tanoim who were sick, they used to damp with a bit of water, damp the dust down so it wouldn't be dusty, or make the bed, or do something that the person couldn't do, sweep the house. You have to do something practical for the person. I suppose in an extreme situation, it might be that just sitting and talking to them is something that they really happen to need at that time. If it is, then you fulfill the mitzvah that way. And if you get it all right, it says that you carry away a 60th of their illness. That depends. According to some opinions, you have to be of the same zodiac as them, and some spiritual connection has to exist between you, or the same age. That's an interesting thing. You could actually help them and let them do something for you that could help them do the mitzvah. But if they're incapable, and they come as a real obligation, and they sit looking at their watch all the time, you should at least be gracious enough to, you know, feel that they, after all, did try and do something positive, even though it wasn't. There's also a good side to it, which a person should never forget, and that is that according to the system of mitzvahs, even at the lowest level, when a person does a mitzvah just because it's an obligation, but a beautiful thing that comes out of it is that people who sick get visited. When people act only spontaneously, they only visit people they want to visit, because they feel warm about it, because they get some kind of feedback, or the worst kind is somebody who's such a do-gooder, they're such an altruistic do-gooder, that they'll visit somebody who's sick because it's and deliberately where they get no thanks for it, because that really makes them feel good. But it's a very selfish action. By the way, it's almost impossible to do any mitzvah of chesed with real chesed. Because the more efficient you become at doing the mitzvah, the more you feel good about it. So there's an inbuilt paradox in doing for other people that's almost impossible to overcome. So at best, and at worst, if they're doing it, because technically they have to, definitely should be gracious, should at least appreciate the mitzvah value. They did take trouble to come, and definitely one should try and feel whatever sincerity you can in the mitzvah. There were great people who put themselves through very, very embarrassing situations in order to break down the pleasure they felt in a mitzvah. I told you the story once about the chassid for the money, yeah? Made himself embarrassed so that he wouldn't be able to feel the pleasure of doing for somebody else, because shame conquers that feeling. But you don't have to go to such extremes. Alavai, we should just go and do what we have to do, even if it's the wrong motivation. You know, I didn't say everybody has to ask a question. Yeah. If a person keeps the basic mitzvahs, is he considered righteous? Righteousness, what we call a tzaddik, has a definition. And a definition of a tzaddik is somebody who does all his obligations. Then he's considered a tzaddik. Not more than he has to do. You follow? All his basic obligations. If it's a mistake, it's a mistake. It's not a problem. By mistake. By accident, he didn't know he gave the wrong change? if it was a genuine accident that he couldn't have helped? Yes, and if it's that kind of accident that results because you're not perfect, there's no punishment, it's annoyance. But
a person who loves God doesn't need to challenge a good person. Just
he's not perfect yet. Yeah. He's judged to the level of how hard he's working on himself compared to what he really could do. I didn't say that. If righteousness has a definition. A tzaddik is somebody who does everything he's supposed to do. Every single thing, that's a tzaddik. Doing more than what you have to do, that's called a chassid. Doesn't mean chassidim, like we have chassidic sects. There may be chassidim also.
But
what's an average mitzvah of the... The list is a lot longer than that. To the extent that he's trying and learning and doing what he can, if he's genuinely trying the best he can, you'll have no black mark against you. You're genuinely trying to the best. No, he's not yet considered righteous. He's considered to be doing the best that he could do. If he wants to be called a tzaddik, he has to get to the level to be doing all his obligations. Yeah. Yes, please.
It's not been discussed before. It sounds like a crazy question. But if a Roman soldier who's done evil his whole life and at the last minute jump into a fire and do genuine shiva, Is it something not feasible then?
Of course a person could do that. I wouldn't hold that too much hope in the case of... Okay, that's it for questions. Yes, please.
If a person keeps mitzvahs but doesn't do them for the good part, he thinks that a person who is not religious but automatically does mitzvahs because they want to do
them. Oh, that's a very difficult and very interesting. Did you hear the question? The question is this. What happens, first of all, we're not able to compare people, okay? We can't do that, but the question's valid. The question is, what happens if you have someone who has... I should have stopped before you. Should have got out of here while I could have. I made questions I can answer. The question is this. What happens if you have someone doing all their obligations, but inwardly they're negative? They're not doing it with a good heart. They keep technically to the letter of what they have to do. And then you have somebody else who's not technically doing what he has to do, but inwardly he has a good heart and good in him. If you examine the question carefully, I'm serious about this, you'll find that the question almost never could exist in practical reality. Let's understand carefully. If a person's got a good heart, it just cannot be that he's never doing anything outwardly that is the expression of that heart. Let's say the person genuinely has affection and love for other people. He's never showing it in any way. So that's not goodness. Do you follow? If the person's never showing... I know what you mean, but let's examine it technically. You follow me? I don't blame you. What I want to get to is to show that to be good inwardly, you have to be good outwardly and technically. That's what I want to try and show. But you can show it logically. Let's start the other way around, because I know what you mean. What you mean is, what about the person who believes in being a good individual? They're really trying. They're not what we call frum, but they're really trying to be a good individual. They really believe that they're being good. They're motivated. They have morals. They have values and so forth. But they're not keeping Torah laws at all. And then you have another individual, he's a black individual, okay, who wears a black coat and all that and keeps the technical observance, but actually inwardly, he's not a Ben Aliyah, he's not working on himself, he doesn't really have a feel for other, you know, the whole thing. I'm not talking about somebody who cheats, like I always say, he goes to shul and davens, but cheats people in his... I'm not talking about that, because that's not called keeping the technical. I'm talking about somebody who really is keeping everything technically. Let's make it clear. So, the answer to that question is a little less complicated, and it's as follows. But it is complicated. It's like this. The real balance between those individuals, only Hashem can judge. Because he takes into account, right, what were the total conditions surrounding that person's behavior. What were all his opportunities, right, and how much of what he's doing right, his own free choice that he's motivating himself to do, how much he's not. When all that's said and done, put together, he'll be judged. It could be that someone in the gutter who's mugging people for a living might be doing better than somebody who's really living correctly. Might be. If he was brought up that way and taught that way as a way of life and he never was given any other opportunity, you follow? And he mugs people a little less cruelly than he has to, let's say. Could be. And he's working on himself that way. You follow? I'm being extreme, but it could. Whereas some person who really has all the reason to be sensitive and just isn't taking any care or stock of what he's doing in life, etc., etc., we can't make those judgments. Okay? But what's important to grasp is this. From that point of view, I know where you're coming from. You're asking the kind of question that many parents often ask, right? Parents say, listen, why do you need all this technical stuff? Can't you be a good Jew? We grew up to be good, decent human beings, you know, with all the right values and so forth and so on. You're involved in all this frum kind of paraphernalia, all this technicalities, that actually you're forgetting to be human and so forth. The truth is that they're usually right. The truth is they're usually right. But again, it's complicated because the reason parents are usually right when they say that is not because intrinsically they're right, it's because the generations have yielded this particular paradox, as I tried to explain before. Most Jewish parents, you're from England, so I don't know how it goes over there. Probably the same. But if in the South African Jewish community, you will, I can assure you that if you go to any Jewish home where the parents are in their mid-40s or above, they're certainly 50 year olds and above, you'll find that, and the children are very frum, let's say, and the parents are not frum at all, you'll find clearly, in terms of normal, balanced human values and what it is to be a mensch, the parents far outstrip the children, right, who have grasped on the superficial technicalities, but they haven't yet driven it in to the personality. But that's not because the technical stuff doesn't make you sensitive. It's because there's a crazy gap in the generations, right, where these kids have been brought up in a superficial world that totally stimulates the superficial all the time. They didn't come across that. That's a unique situation. But what I'd like to try and get across, it's very hard, is this. If you're not doing the right technical actions outside, you really can't be a good person. You have to understand that. First of all, at a practical level, the technical requirements are, I'll give you an example. The easiest way to handle this is just to make it real, practical, and real and crude. Okay? Those people who tell you that they're being good individuals, they're being good, they tell you, why do I need all this stuff, keeping Shabbos and doing all the stuff that you're doing? I'm a good human being, I don't harm anyone. Okay? Sit around those individuals for a couple of hours, you will hear the most scathing Lashon Hara spoken by those individuals. They wouldn't believe it if you try to convey it to them because they don't understand the concept. They say, if they'll say something negative about someone, and you'll explain to them, that destroys worlds. It's the most horrendous thing you can do. They'll say, but it's true. It's true. What I said about that person is, and they'll be right about it. Accurate perception, and it's true. But it destroys, it's worse than murder, it says in some ways. Now they, in other words, that's just an example. They understand that they've been good and motivated and something, but they just don't know what damage they're doing in other areas. You follow me? The things they're doing interpersonally, which leave enormous scars. They think they're doing it because they have a set of ideals and values, but it's twisted. They're doing things, I'll give you another example. Often they do things that modern psychology says they should do. But those are terribly destructive things. Modern psychology says that you should let it all out. You shouldn't hold anything in. Be totally honest, be totally open. So what happens? You let it all out and you destroy the relationship. Definitely. The Torah way is that you have to be a very good actor. Definitely you don't say things that will regret later. You don't say things about a person and to a person, no matter how true it is. Especially in an intimate personal, you don't do that. You have to show ultimate, tremendous respect all the time. You have to get across the message of what they're doing wrong in the right way at the right time. You follow me? So this person, in other words, they are holding true to a set of values that they think is a set of values. But if you examine it objectively in the world, and of course if you take it further, which I'm not going to go into, from a mystical basis, no matter how good they feel about it, but they're wrecking the world. Never mind interpersonally, they're not keeping Shabbos. So they think they're being a good person. But they are damaging every single Jew, and they're damaging the whole cosmic structure. You'd never get that across to them, because they've no concept of how the mechanisms work in a transcendent dimension and how they come down and affect us. So that you'd never get across to them without a long, long, long educational process that they are voluntarily going through, which they aren't. But that you'll never...
Are you saying that
No, you see, the fact is that in terms of damage and what's being done in the world, and if you should ever choose what you should do, it's as I said, bad or worse than somebody else, I'm not prepared to say. Because that's what I try to start off with. I would never say they're worse, because they are being true to the best they can do. And if they genuinely are doing, if it's parents who were brought up in an environment, that they were never given anything better than that, and they were taught secular, non-Jewish values, and they're holding true to those values, and they're genuinely, sincerely doing the best they can in that system, Shem won't hold it against them. In extreme case, the Gemara talks about is a child who was brought up by non-Jews from when he was a baby. He doesn't even know he's Jewish. Shem's not going to keep it, hold it against him for not keeping Shabbos. Because it was beyond the scope of what he could have done. So therefore, to say that they're worse than someone, we wouldn't say. Unfortunately, it's a little more complicated. I'm not going to go into the details, but the halachic commentaries argue about this. Now, I just want you to understand one thing. When a child is given away in the Second World War to non-Jews and brought up as a Catholic child and never discovered that they were Jewish, when that child doesn't keep Shabbos, and the Rambam says even if you tell them that they're Jewish and they still don't keep anything, it's virtually irrelevant because the whole internal mechanism just can't, they just can't assimilate that fact like instantaneously. Therefore, it's not held against them at all. But where they do have a debate, and this is much more touchy, is what about people who are in between? They were brought up Jewish, they know they're Jewish, but they never were given a real chance at an insight into what it means spiritually and the beauty of it. So on the one hand, they don't really know. On the other hand, they have got access to the information. There is a spark. They could have the knowledge if they wanted. There must have been some point in their life where they were challenged a little bit. Okay. So some authorities say, the Rambam among them, says you still don't hold it against them because, in generally speaking, they just couldn't do better than that, and therefore the way to deal with them is kindly, try and show them what you can, try and get them involved, etc. There are others, however, who say that they are accountable because technically they did know, they could have had the information, they should have studied it, they should have logically said to themselves that this whole thing that we call Bible or Divine or what, you know, is a definite possibility, and there's nothing more important than that if it does true, and therefore I should check it out, and if they didn't, it was a willful, you know, backing off from the obligation. That's a very complex, we prefer to take the more kindly, you know, view and not make judgments about other people, you know. Just one final practical point. I feel a lot of these questions go around parents, that they often do. There's no mitzvah to makarav your parents. There's no mitzvah to try and make parents from. There's a mitzvah to honor and respect your parents, kibud avayim. That you have to do. And that's a very detailed mitzvah. You may not sit in their chair, you may not use their first name, you may not contradict their words, okay? All those things are definite Torah obligations that you have to observe by your parents. To make them more religious, it doesn't say you have to do anyway. First of all. Second of all, you'll never make them more religious by trying. Okay? You know, they remember you when they changed your nappies. You know, diapers in England, whatever. Nappies. When they knew you that way. You're now going to tell them about the spiritual reality and the next world and all that. They're not going to buy it from you. And therefore, you wouldn't succeed anyway making your parents from. The only way you do, if you're lucky, you've got special parents, and you're able to talk about these things, or somehow they get involved. Or, if you know how to go about doing things, you leave certain books and tapes and cassettes and things lying around half. you leave them around half hidden, so that when you're out, they'll sneak a look and they'll think. But if you tell them, they definitely won't. Okay, you know, you have to know how to bring up parents. Okay, maybe if there's one more question, then we'll, yeah, please. I think so. Can I try and rephrase it? Do you mean this, that sometimes when you engage in a relationship because you're obliged to mitzvah-wise, let's yeah. say, or you have to.
Well, sometimes in interactions with any person, you have a responsibility of giving to that person. I mean, we yeah. have a responsibility. But very often giving is a reflection of potentially abusive relationship.
I don't follow. Let's say you give and they give you back negative. What should you do?
Yeah.
Oh, so you have to make a decision. If you can avoid the relationship, if it's not an essential one, and the net outcome is less, in other words, the net debit is more than the net gain, you should avoid that relationship. Okay? And women are often subject to engaging in relationships that they shouldn't. They often bond in a situation because of their nature of giving, where they can actually see intellectually that it will be their downfall. Most women have been through such experiences, and yet they just feel the need to continue the relationship for whatever reason. Okay, that's a particular strength of a woman that leads to a particular problem. Yeah? If that happens to be the case, and you can use your head instead of your heart, and you can not engage in that relationship and put that effort of positivity in the world elsewhere, you definitely should do that. Sometimes you can't avoid the relationship, it's an essential one. So then again, you have to make the decision about how you can minimize the negativity that's going to come out of it and the positivity. And that you have to discuss the specific case. the Rambam says that you're always affected by your experiences. That means if you go into an environment where you try and give and be positive, but the overall situation is negative, even if you do put in, but you'll be negatively affected. There's nothing that you ever go through that doesn't leave its mark on you. And therefore, when you make a calculation about what you should be putting into this situation, relationship, person, etc., you have to balance against that your own purity and what it's going to do to you. The first obligation is to yourself. Because you'll never be worth anything to anybody else if you haven't first taken care of who you are, and you're not doing that all the time. Are you with me? So if you go into a relationship where you know that you're going to maybe do something, doubtful, maybe yes, maybe not, and even if you definitely are, but you're going to come out of this scarred, right, in this area, even if you can give, you shouldn't in that area. I mean, it's very vague, you have to know the specifics. And we learn it from classical sources, that says that the classical source, and I'll just finish with this, the classical source is that Abraham Avinu and his nephew Lot, both had an intense message, an incredible gift, and a message to give the world. So when they split, they both had to assess where they were going to locate themselves in order to give that message most effectively. So Lot, who was a very great man, an incredibly great man, he learned from his great uncle, the greatest man in the world, decided to go and locate himself in Sodom, in Stone, because it was the worst place on earth. Why? Because that's where people really needed him. That's where he'd really be able to give. He knew he'd be endangering his own purity in such a place, but he thought he was great enough to handle it. And if anyone was going to change the world, that's where you have to go. So he went into that environment in order to give to the people who really needed it. And he really gave fantastically. His daughter was killed by the people there. It says that he went in to teach kindness and hospitality, which is what he learned. The value in Stone was the exact opposite. You know, you weren't allowed to host a stranger. You weren't allowed to give food to anybody from out of town on pain of death. Once his daughter, who was so intensely trained by him, gave some food to a traveler, they tied her down on the rooftop and smeared it with honey and let the bee sting her to death. Okay, that was a punishment for someone who had given to somebody, okay? So he gave a child for that. And then he took strangers into his home at the cost of his life, and he went out to face the crowd. They wanted to kill him. And he miraculously was a very, very great man. But underlying it all, it says, was a desire to be in a place of immorality. It means a very, very hidden desire. He was an incredible man who was prepared to give his life for his values, but somewhere in the heart of it, there was that, and somewhere he was tainted and it came out negative. And they often say that, Bala Musa say that if a man goes to a brothel to convert the girls over there, then you must understand that even if he does that, which he won't do, but what he's going for is because, Father, it's that underlying, even just the fantasy of it, but that's underlying it. Abraham Avinu, had an incredible message to give the world, and he really was the one who could have handled it there, and he went and sat in the desert. In the desert! The man who had the ultimate message for the world, he went and located his tent in the desert. But ultimately, people came, and they saw, and his message, and I think I once told you, I don't know if you were here, another 30 seconds? Yeah. It happened to me once, that when I was getting married, in fact, actually his name was Avram also, he was Rabbi Hassan, he was a very wonderful teacher who got many of us going here in Johannesburg today, lives in Manchester. When we decided to get married, my wife and I went to him, and we said we wanted him to be to be the Masada Kedushin, wanted him to marry us. So he was very, very nice about it, but he said to me, wished us all well, and so on. He said, but I'm not coming to your wedding. So I said, you're not coming to my wedding. You know, you're my teacher, you're my Rebbe, I didn't exactly know how to speak to a Rebbe yet in those days. I wasn't as, you know, humble as I should have been. I said to him, you know, what's the problem? You know, my wedding, you know, you're responsible for me, the whole thing, you're not coming. So he said to me, I want you to understand, your wedding's in the summer, and there will be women at your wedding dressed in such a way that I can't go and look at the women. I can't be present at such a place. So I said to him, but that's crazy. I said, if there's anybody who could handle it, it's you. The people who are coming shouldn't come. You follow? The men who are coming to that wedding will tell them not to come. They're going to be harmed. If anybody's going to be harmed, it's them. But you know how to handle these situations. You've got your mind right already. So you won't be harmed by the situation. It's crazy. So he smiled at me very nicely, and he told me that that's exactly what happened to Avram Avinu. That he wanted to affect the world, so went and he lived in the desert. He didn't come to my wedding. His wife came. Right? But he didn't come. It was hard to understand at the time, but I learned more from the principal and from his commitment to it and what he gave up. He very much wanted to be there. And it doesn't feel like not coming. Okay.